And of course, he did that because he knew it was the right thing to do, and it thrust him into the political maelstrom that was, of course, present in 1770 and thereafter in Boston and the environs. He, as I'm sure you all know, went on to become the second president of the United States after serving as George Washington's vice president. We remember him on July the 3rd and July the 4th, not so much only because of the birth of our country occurred in 1776 on the 4th of July, but as some of you may know, July the 4th, 1797, July the 4th in 1826 was the year that he died, on the 4th of July. And remarkably, he died on the same day as the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, died. Now, both of those people had extraordinarily divergent views on how criminal law and crimes and authority ought to be delivered in the United States, but it was perhaps the most remarkable hallmark of our country and its birth that these two individuals with remarkably different views on how a country ought to be run could, one after the other, be elected and carried on their duties as president and chief executive of the country during its formative years. Now here we are so many years later, 185 years later, we are once again governed by a president who had extraordinarily divergent views from his predecessor president, not perhaps so different as between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And our current president is faced with just the sort of issues that individuals are faced when they have to deal with those who are inclined to violate the rules. So today's show, in large measure, is going to focus on securities fraud, commercial fraud, commercial crimes, those sorts of issues, the Madoff case, how can that happen? And I want to give you just a little bit of background before I introduce you to our guest, who will be calling in, I believe, from North Carolina shortly, Tess Konchick. There are, in the United States today, 311 million people. Most of them, and therefore most of you, have some of their money, some of their investment, some interest in securities. And so each of you care about what happens to that money, who's handling it, what sort of people they are, whether they're committing crimes with your money, whether you're losing money. These are issues you should care about. 64% of Americans, that's 200 million Americans, have money invested in the stock market. And every year, $40 billion, that's 40 billion with a B, $40 billion are stolen or is lost from the securities interest industry by people who are in one way or another committing crimes. That comes out to $200 per person per year. So every one of you who are listening to this show, every year, you're giving up at least $200 to people who are stealing money from you. If you think that talking about the securities industry and commercial fraud and securities fraud doesn't affect you, then let me just invite you to write a check for $200 to WGXC every year instead, and let's just call it a day. The truth is, though, that you should care about keeping that money in your pocket, and so we have the opportunity today to talk about the sorts of issues that that affect keeping that money in your pocket and understanding how it is that $40 billion a year flows out of our collective pockets and into the pockets of criminals and people who don't deserve that money. So as I mentioned before, we have calling in from North Carolina, although she lives in Florida, Tess Konchik. Tess has a quite an incredible arc to her career. She's a lawyer, like myself. Unlike myself, however, after law school, she went on to work in the securities industry. She worked first at a very well-known private firm, Findlay Kimball Wagner, in Washington, D.C., at which she worked on securities issues. And thereafter went to work at the Securities and Exchange Commission in their enforcement division. And while there, she participated in the prosecution of people like Michael Milken, who's known for having been convicted of a variety of crimes, including fraud and insider trading and related to the issuance of junk bonds and selling of junk bonds. And after her work at the SEC, she went to work for Merrill Lynch, in their compliance division, making sure that the people who are in charge of our money and the money of our pensions and such followed the rules. So she's had a remarkable arc to her career, and interestingly, at this point, she's involved in writing a book, a historical analysis of greed in America. A subject upon which she has had an incredibly up close and personal look, both as a prosecutor and as a person in charge with compliance. And so, with that, I want to just touch a little bit on the sorts of issues that that Tess and I are going to talk about. When we talk about securities fraud, we talk about a whole variety of illegal acts that take place in the security industry. That ranges from stockbroker schemes to insider trading to corporate misstatement of financial information, efforts to conceal debt. Security fraud falls under the general category of crime called white-collar crime. And white-collar crime is unlawful activity that takes place in a professional or business setting in order to achieve a financial benefit at the expense of another. It's most of the work that I personally do in my own work involves white-collar crime. So securities fraud is a kind of act or an omission, a failure to act, that's carried out by one party in order to manipulate the market by concealing or distorting information. And it can be carried out by securities professionals, dealers, brokers, financial advisors, analysts. It may be committed by a corporation. It could be perpetrated by a private investor. There's a whole variety of targets of securities fraud. They can target consumers. They can target corporations. In general, securities professionals, that is, your brokers, your securities dealers, those who have access to information that could affect the marketplace, these people have a fiduciary duty. It means a duty to behave honestly, professionally, and with an eye towards preserving the interests of their investors and stockholders, and they have to act in good faith and have fair dealings in all their professional transactions. So securities fraud is not only a breach of a fiduciary responsibility, it's also a criminal offense. And I'd like to now introduce you to Tess Konchik, who's on the line, and
Tess, are you there?
Hello, Dan. How are you?
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad we've got you on. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
That's great, and I can hear you too. I trust that our audience can hear us as well. Tess, I want to first of all thank you for spending your July 3rd with us. I know you're in North Carolina visiting family, and I hope that my introduction of you was at least accurate enough.
It was very accurate.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm very flattered by your description of me.
All right. Tess, in anticipation of the show, we've spoken a little bit, and what I'm clear about is, as a investor in the world, as a citizen who reads the newspapers, I read headlines over and over again about huge, enormous frauds that take place, in which investors lose just enormous amounts of money, and I'm dumbstruck, both as a citizen and as an investor, that these sorts of things can happen. And of course, not only can they happen, but they have happened with disturbing regularity for years and years and years. You've been on the forefront of these sorts of issues over the years. Why does it happen? How does it happen?
I think that when there are opportunities to make money, I think human nature is, at least in this country, is to try to make money. And that may involve unlawful activity. And first of all, you know, the securities markets are regulated. They began to be regulated in the 30s with the passage of the Securities Act of 1933. And then the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, which created the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has been at the forefront of regulating and overseeing the securities markets with an intent and a mandate to ensure investor protection. One of the, you know, as someone who's worked at the SEC, you know, one of the problems we've had is we can't be everywhere. We couldn't be everywhere, and the SEC, unlike a criminal investigation, can't tap phones but does have subpoena power to compel testimony before it. But some of the biggest cases that the SEC was able to prosecute was the result of whistleblowers or people tipping. People who were good citizens and alerted the SEC to a problem. And that was the case with Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken and the Drexel case.
So just for those of us who perhaps were not even alive at the time that Ivan Boesky was prosecuted, can you tell us just in a nutshell what those cases were about?
Yes, certainly. Ivan Boesky was a well-known arbitrageur in New York City in the 70s and the 80s, and he would trade on information about mergers and acquisitions and try to take advantage of price differentials. But it turned out that he was also making a lot of money based on obtaining inside information from people who had information about the timing of mergers and acquisitions.
So that's a phrase that we're going to talk about in a little more detail later, insider information. It's a phrase that, of course, we read about in the newspaper and in headlines pretty regularly. And let's go forward and tell us what the Drexel Burnham matter was and Michael Milken. And then let's talk about how it was that they were identified as perpetrators of crimes and what those crimes were.
Well, Michael Milken was the head of the junk bond desk at Drexel Burnham Wimbare. Drexel Burnham was a well-known brokerage firm on Wall Street. Michael Milken ran the junk bond desk in California, in Beverly Hills, and he would create these securities, junk bonds, that were below market grade, and he was selling them to a lot of institutions that shouldn't have been buying them, like savings and loans organizations. And it was mainly because of, under the Reagan administration, Congress passed laws easing investment restrictions for savings and loans so that they could buy below market securities.
And when he was marketing those, did he suggest to anybody that these were anything other than junk bonds?
Not in the sense that he was claiming that they were airtight investments. However, the returns were so lucrative, and he also created a market. So, in other words, if a savings and loan wanted to sell or get rid of that investment, Michael Milken was maintaining a market in buying back those securities. So it seemed like a sure bet. However, the problem arose where many of the underlying companies who issued these junk bonds couldn't pay these high rates of interest. And so the net result was savings and loans lost a lot of money, and many went out of business because of it.
Well, now, that, it sounds to me as though Michael Milken found an opportunity to create an investment vehicle, a bond. They're called junk bonds because they were promises by companies that perhaps were not in very good financial situations to pay money to investors. And he found an opportunity to create a financial instrument. Then he sold those financial instruments to people who believed that they were better than they actually were. And when ultimately those companies couldn't pay the bonds, they defaulted on them. And the people who had purchased them realized that what they had purchased was valueless. Is that about right?
That is a large part of it. And I think another part of it is as time went on, the market for these securities dried up so that they couldn't get rid of them. And also, a lot of the bonds were issued to support mergers and acquisitions. In the 80s, there was a frenzy for leverage buyouts and mergers and acquisitions and takeovers. And some of those failed. And if they failed, then the company couldn't meet their obligations to pay the high interest rates that junk bonds afforded. So that contributed to the problem.
And now, and why isn't this, why wasn't that just a, you know, a caveat emptor, a buyer beware situation? Here's Michael Milken out there hawking something that he's created to people hungry to make a buck on something, which looks like a good deal. And when ultimately it turns out not to be such a good deal, why isn't that just, buyer beware? If it looks too good, don't buy it. Why is it a crime? Where's the crime in what he did?
Well, I think you have a point about buyer beware, and I think part of the issue was savings and loans shouldn't have been in this business. The regulations used to require that savings and loans buy AAA securities, and there was a concern for the safety of their depositors. And allowing them to buy risky investments was a big problem for them.
What is it, when you say AAA securities, what does that mean?
Well, there are rating agencies such as Standard & Poor's and Moody's that look at companies and look at securities and assign a rating based upon their creditworthiness. So a AAA rating is the top rating you can get. And meaning that there is a lot of safety in investing in that company or that security because it's deemed very creditworthy.
So just so I understand it and so our listeners understand it, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, they don't sound like government agencies.
They're not.
So those are private businesses that make money by rating investment vehicles that the rest of us in the world buy. Is that right?
Yeah.
And let's just understand, who pays them money to rate those investment vehicles?
The companies they're rating.
I get it. So if I'm a company and I want to issue a bond, I go through that process, and then I go to something like Moody's or Standard & Poor's, and I say, here's a pile of money. Please rate my bonds.
That's true. It's also really the companies that are issuing the securities will go to the rating agencies and ask to assign a rating so that they can sell the securities that they're offering. So, in other words, a company such as, let's say, a Morgan Stanley will underwrite an issuance of securities for sale to the public. And as part of that, they will, and they receive compensation if they're making an offering for a company. They'll receive compensation from that company. And included in that compensation, though, is money that is paid to rating agencies in order to assign a rating to that offering so that they can tell people, well, this is very creditworthy. It's something you should buy.
As an investor in the world, I'm troubled by that. I can't imagine why we're not all troubled by that. You know, I'm a lawyer, and the notion that that I could go out in the world and pay money to somebody to say that I'm the best lawyer there is out there, or amongst the best lawyers there are out there, and that's why they should hire me, that, of course, would land me in pretty significant hot water. I'm not allowed to do that, regardless of what the truth of that may or may not be. How is it not a terrible conflict of interest for the very company that's seeking to have their own investment vehicle rated to be paying the company that's doing the rating?
Well, you raise an interesting question, and that's actually being reviewed now by the SEC, and this was required by a major overhaul of the securities regulation passed by Congress a couple of years ago, the Dodd-Frank bill. And they're looking at changing this business model that the issuer pays for the rating because it could be deemed a conflict of interest. And I think you raise a very important point that's being looked at right now.
Well, you know, the fact of the potential of the conflict of interest in involved in the rating of these investment vehicles, it didn't first come to light in the Michael Milken case. This has been an issue throughout the history of rating agencies. Isn't that correct?
I think so, but it really came to light with the ratings of mortgage-related securities as well. I mean, I think with junk bonds, the rating agencies were correct in how they rated the securities. They were below investment grade, and that's what Michael Milken sold. There was never an issue about whether they were at the highest level of creditworthiness. It was clear that they were junk. But you had more of an issue when it came to the mortgage-related securities.
So when you talk about the mortgage-related securities, you've now skipped forward 20-something years,
right,
to the headlines that have been screaming at us for the past several years about mortgage-backed securities, where people are individual homeowners and people who want to purchase homes are permitted to buy homes and finance them with mortgages without any background check, without any financial ability to repay. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, and I raised that primarily because it was in this context that Congress and the regulators started really looking at the role of the rating agencies. And so I would say that you could look back and there were issues historically about possible conflicts of interest, but it seemed to work okay, and, you know, there weren't many big issues raised. I mean, you know, with Milken, for example, he wasn't really convicted of doing anything improper in the junk bond market. He was, convicted, and when I was at the SEC, we worked closely with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. He was convicted of failing to disclose information relating to his holdings of securities, and he was not convicted of insider trading. He was rather convicted of what might seem to be a more, let's say, administrative type of requirement in the SEC rules that requires investors who have a position in a company, take a position of 5% or more, that they need to disclose that in filings with the SEC, and he failed to do that.
So Michael Milken was taking a position in the companies that were issuing bonds that he was then selling to savings and loans banks?
Yes, and it was, much of it was based on inside information, but he was not convicted of that.
The savings and loans institutions that were investing in these junk bonds, knowing that they were not AAA rated, in fact that they were junk bonds, why does that point a finger at Michael Milken for having done something wrong? And wasn't it an indication of Michael Milken's commitment? And I'm not defending him here, but I'm trying to understand why he was prosecuted at all. Wasn't it a demonstration of his commitment and investment in the companies that were issuing these bonds that he would, in fact, put his own money on the line, backing those in those companies that were issuing those bonds?
Well, again, he wasn't convicted he wasn't convicted for any of his activities relating to the junk bond market. I think I would point fingers at those SNLs and those executive officers at these savings and loans who developed personal relationships with Michael Milken and just believed that he knew he was a genius and he knew what he was doing. And, you know, Michael Milken is a very bright man, and you know, he did pioneer the rise of the junk bond market, but what he really did that was illegal was he was manipulating the price of securities based upon inside information or to help friends of his take over companies. He was also engaged in something known as parking of stock, so he would hide ownership of securities. If someone was trying to, for example, if a company or an individual was trying to buy out another company but didn't want the market to know that they were doing that, Michael Milken would buy it on their behalf and not disclose the fact that they were really owned by somebody else.
All right. So we know that people who are registered and licensed by the security industry have a fiduciary duty to the various investors to be honest and above board and make the disclosures that they're obligated to make, and it's clear that he violated those rules.
Exactly.
A couple of times now you've mentioned the term insider trading or inside information. What is that all about?
Inside information and insider trading, insider trading is trading on the basis of quote-unquote inside information. And under the securities laws, you can be convicted of, or you can be guilty of, or violate the securities anti-fraud statute by engaging in inside information. And insider trading has been defined over the years, not just through the regulations of the SEC, but also by the Supreme Court. And inside information relates to having material non-public information relating to a company or a transaction, for example. And materiality is a key word here, and that means that the information would be important to an investor's investment decision.
So if a corporate insider knew that this corporation was changing the brand of the toilet paper being put in the corporate bathrooms, that would not be material inside information. But if he knew that that corporation was about to announce a merger with another company that would affect the value of the stock, that would be material inside information.
Absolutely. But, you know, one key element here is, and the Supreme Court made it clear that not every transaction on inside information is a violation of the law.
Right.
You have to have a fiduciary relationship of trust or confidence, with the company, or where you're misappropriating information from the company. So if I'm on the subway in New York and I hear a couple of people, dressed in business suits talking about, well, there's going to be a big transaction tomorrow and I'd buy XYZ securities if I were you. I, as the rider on the subway, I don't owe a duty to the company, and I don't know who these people are. And if I buy, it'd be hard to charge me with insider trading.
Yeah, it might not be hard to charge you, but it would be hard to convict you.
Yeah, I mean, I could. You're right. I could be charged.
Said the defense attorney. Since we know we can charge a ham sandwich, right?
Yeah, I know. Right. But at the SEC, we would be a little bit more careful. We'd be kind of afraid to charge somebody like that. There's another element, Dan, that is really, akin to, beyond a reasonable doubt in the criminal side, is that you have to do this with what is called scienter. That is, you know or should have known that this information was material to the market.
Correct. So whether you happen to be a corporate executive with access to material information or whether you happen to be a janitor at a corporation and therefore read a piece of paper that was being thrown out and trade on that, even that janitor could be charged with trading on inside information because he worked for that corporation. Isn't that correct?
I think that's possible.
We saw that, of course, a couple of years ago when people who work at financial printing houses had access to financial information, traded on that, or gave that information to other people who traded on it, and they were charged and successfully convicted of trading on inside information.
Yes, I mean, a famous printing case was SEC v. Chiarella, and that's correct. One of the actually a big insider trading case involved an individual named Dennis Levine, who ultimately led the SEC to Ivan Boesky, and then Boesky led the SEC to Michael Milken and Drexel. And he was at the epicenter of Wall Street insider trading in the 80s. And he worked for Drexel Burnham Lambert, and he had, he obtained a lot of information about upcoming mergers and acquisitions. And he traded on that information through offshore accounts.
Right. And so I'm not completely clear why we should care that people trade on inside information. I know I've done a little bit of research, and I know that up until fairly recently in Japan, for instance, it was the normal course and common sense that that people with information would trade on it and make money. Why wouldn't they? And how is it that, why do I care as an investor if a corporate insider knows that there's a merger coming? Let's imagine that I own shares in Ford Corporation and a Ford corporate officer knows that they're coming out with an engine that gets 100 miles a gallon. And so he goes out and buys a lot of Ford stock. I own Ford stock as well. And they make that that announcement. The Ford stock goes through the roof. He makes money. I make money. Why do I care that he traded on inside information?
Because you're missing a level playing field. And that's the sum and substance of why the securities laws came into being. The frenzied activity in the stock market in the 20s that led to the market crash, a lot of people were trading on inside information. And among other things, I mean, that wasn't the only cause of the crash, but one of the primary bases for the creation of the SEC and the passage of the securities laws was to create a level playing field so that John Doe, you know, Mr. American who lives in small town America, would not be harmed and would have the same opportunities as any other investor to make money in the stock market. And it's about maintaining the integrity of the market. And that's why you had a lot of regulation, and that's also why self-regulation came into, you know, prominence. In other words, the stock exchanges had their own compliance, and they oversaw trading to ensure that companies weren't taking advantage of inside information or manipulating the market. So it really is about letting Main Street have as much of a chance of making money in the stock market as Wall Street.
All right. So it's
it's a question of fairness. And I think it's part of American culture, you know, about you know, letting the little guy try to get ahead. And, you know, maybe the little guy is allowed to be greedy and is allowed to act on that greed. I think in other countries, and I think this is also true in Germany, it's not considered to be a bad thing. It's considered to be normal that, you know, insiders would take advantage of information that they have that the public doesn't have.
Right. Well, you know, if we're talking about it being okay to be greedy, certainly the headlines that have captivated most of us for over the past 2 years involve Bernie Madoff and the greed both that he exemplified, but in large measure, I have to say, and I don't really mean to blame the victim so much, the greed that was exemplified by his hundreds and hundreds of investors who maybe really should have known better. How did a Bernie Madoff happen? And let me just for our listeners who have been living under a rock for the past couple of years, explain that that Bernie Madoff was an investment advisor who collected billions, with a B, billions and billions of dollars from investors throughout the world. I explained to them that they could expect not extraordinary returns, but extraordinarily regular returns, 10%, 8%, 12% a year, year after year after year, while the rest of us were riding the rapids of a declining tech bubble and then a declining tech market, and people's stocks dropped 50% or 60%. If you were a Bernie Madoff investor, you just continued to plod along very happily with your 8 or 10% returns year after year after year. We came to learn, of course, that the way that he did that was by stealing money from investors and giving it to other investors in a process known as a Ponzi scheme, and Bernie is now into his second year of 150 years that he was sentenced to in a federal prison. How with the SEC out there, with prosecutors out there, with regulators out there, in what I think is perhaps the singularly most regulated in securities marketplace in the world, how did a Bernie Madoff happen?
You know Murphy's Law.
I know Murphy's Law. Do I know, if anybody knows Murphy's Law, I know Murphy's Law.
If anything can go wrong, it will. That's almost a great description for Bernie Madoff. And a lot of warning signs were unheeded. You know, Madoff wasn't an unknown quantity. He had a track record. He, in fact, was prominent in the securities industry and advocated important regulations, and that, you know, he thought the SEC was important, and he was very concerned with his reputation. What he obviously didn't disclose was he wasn't investing his clients' money.
Well, when you say he didn't disclose it, there are squads of regulators out there, are there not, at the SEC who go to people like investor advisors like Bernie Madoff and ask him questions about his investments so that he can continue to engage in his activities. They went to him, didn't they?
Well, you raise a good question, and the SEC doesn't really have squads of investigators, and the SEC has always been under pressure from Congress to have to weaken their budgets, especially under Republican administrations. I'll be honest, say that, you know, the SEC actually, as a sidebar, brings in more money in terms of getting money back in penalties and fines than their budget. And they don't have a lot of investigators, I think, that they should have. And they also have investigators who, frankly, may not be well experienced in securities markets.
Well, okay, I'm hearing a bit of, and I don't mean this as an attack on you, Tess, but I'm hearing a bit of an apology for the SEC, the poor U.S. government just wasn't up to the Bernie Madoff challenge.
Well, it's half an apology, and it's also probably advocating for people to support SEC regulation and giving them the budget that they need to better, you know, police our securities markets. However,
okay.
they had an opportunity here when they went in to inspect Bernie Madoff, and they just didn't ask the right questions.
So the questions that they asked Bernie were, how's it going, Bernie? How about those Mets? Because the question that they didn't ask him was the only question that we would expect them to ask, which was, where's the money?
Yeah, show us, give us samples of your account statements, the firm's account statements that show where the investment money is. All the money you take in from your valued investors, where is that money invested? Show us the records of the securities you've invested in.
That was the question that they couldn't come up with.
But
the fact of the matter is, Tess, that they, in fact, didn't even need to come up with that question, did they? Because wasn't there a person who had come forward to the SEC years before Bernie was finally charged with a crime and said, Bernie Madoff is a crook. It can't be working the way that he said that it's working.
Harry Markopoulos, and that's who you're referring to, gave the SEC almost a blueprint for investigating Madoff in terms of laying out the reason why Bernie Madoff was engaged in a massive Ponzi scheme.
But the truth was, of course, that Bernie Madoff walked like a duck, he talked like a duck, He was one of them. He was one of the titans of Wall Street. He was somebody that couldn't be committing the kind of fraud that ultimately he was found to have been committing. And so Mr. Markopoulos was disbelieved. Isn't that right?
He was, and I think they thought he was a little bit of a nut job. And I will say that at the SEC, we often had people who were a little wacky who would come in and say there were massive frauds, and they weren't credible. So you always take this with a little bit of, you know, skepticism. However, in this case, Markopoulos was right. He was right. He basically said there's no way Madoff can be making the returns he's claiming to be made in these markets. And in this case, the SEC really should have followed up. And they made some efforts to follow up, but then it dropped off the radar screen, and I can't explain why that happened. Seriously, they should have sent in senior people to ask Madoff. And Madoff always cooperated with the SEC. It wasn't like, you know, he hired defense attorneys who, you know, stonewalled the SEC. That wasn't true. They just didn't ask him for the documents that would have shown this was a major fraud.
Right. Well, Tess, we're coming close to the end of our hour, and I wanted to return to something that I mentioned briefly in my introduction of you, and that is the work that you're working on now, which I find to be absolutely fascinating concerning the history of greed in America. And of course, without greed in America, I'd be out of work in large measure. So I'd like to hear from you a little bit about how you feel. What role does greed play in our culture today, and where does it come from? It's telling that when you look, I think, at the history of what drives criminal behavior, greed is right at the bottom of it. When you look at a Bernie Madoff, he went to exactly the right place to get what he wanted to get. Sort of like Willie Sutton, a very famous bank robber for years and years, robbed hundreds of banks across the country. And when finally he was asked why did he rob banks, he said, "Well, that's where the money is." And he was driven by a desire to increase his own personal holdings, and that's a kind of greed. I wonder, is that the kind of greed that you're exploring in your most recent book?
Yes,
we only have about another 2 or 3 minutes to go.
Okay, and I'll say, you know, it's the warped golden rule. He who has the most gold rules. And, you know, we live in a very material culture, and especially after World War II, you had a middle class that had more money, disposable income, than ever before, and they were courted by Wall Street and others that, wow, you know, you can make money. You can have a nice lifestyle. Something that was not available to the average Joe before, you know, World War II. And I think that, you know, for the first time, you had people who could, for example, go to Wall Street, didn't even need a college degree, and could make millions of dollars. And I think greed is a driving force in our psyche in this country.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
It's actually produced some good results. I mean, some of the robber barons actually founded a lot of our museums and libraries and other cultural institutions, and you have others today who have made a lot of money out of their companies, and Warren Buffett's an example, and you know they have foundations that are giving away a lot of money for good causes. But you have a lot of people who don't do that, you know. So I think that greed will always be a part of getting ahead, and we see it all the time. We saw in the mortgage subprime mortgage meltdown, where they created securities that were basically had little value, but were presented as something that the average individual could invest in, and that made them a lot of money. And, you know, I think greed is something that drives the markets and will always drive human nature.
Well, Gordon Gekko said it, right?
Greed is good.
Greed is good. Tess, with that, I want to thank you so much for taking your Sunday morning off to be with us. This has been insightful for me, extraordinarily interesting, and I hope you'll accept our thanks for participating.
I really enjoyed my time talking to you, Dan.
Tess, thanks so much, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
To the rest of our audience, I'll leave you with the idea that whether or not you're driven by greed, if you fall under the specter of the criminal justice system, remember that your criminal defense attorney is there to stand by you.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point, you're gonna need somebody to stand by you. Oh, yeah, oh, my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gon' need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got, all the friends you got, you gon' need somebody to stand by you.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and that moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. No, I won't shed one tear just as long as your people come and stand by me.